Welcome to Consider This, the popular podcast series brought to you by the Organization of Legal Professionals. I'm your host, Bridget Novak. This series will focus on the legal industry, current trends, substantive issues, and career perspectives. Each program will run approximately 15 minutes. We hope you stay tuned for this program and join us for others in the future.
Hello, and welcome to part two of this two-part special on the question, can e-discovery violate due process? I'm Ron Friedman, a consultant with Fireman & Company, and I blog at Strategic Legal Technology, where I have been covering e-discovery and litigation support for 10 years. My guests are John Beisner and Rich Bernardo with Skadden Arps. John is a partner in Skadden's Washington, D.C. office. Rich is a counsel in Skadden's New York office. We'll pick up on this part of the program with where we left off last time. In part one, we explored the constitutionality of e-discovery and whether it may violate due process. Here, we'll do a deeper dive into the proposed changes in the federal rules of discovery and whether that might correct the problems. You're more familiar with the proposed rule changes, but as I've read them and even as you described them in the article, is it a matter of the wording and that the words we have aren't right, or is it a matter of how the courts are likely to interpret them? Because there is the 1983 rule, which suggests proportionality, and you explain has been, well, my words, not yours, honored primarily in the breach. So how much of this is the wording versus the judicial mindset?
Well, I think it's both. I think the amendments to the rules certainly increase the attention to proportionality, but proportionality still is just a concept of what discovery gets taken. It's not a concept of who gets to take it. And frequently, and it's very easy, for courts to view something as satisfying the proportionality requirements. And part of this discussion is to require judges to look at it not just from a proportionality standpoint, but to look at it from a very specific cost standpoint, or to do something so that that concept is on the table. So I think it's more than just the words in the rule. It's the absence of the words in the proposed rule that's important, and I think gives rise to this constitutional issue.
Yeah, to take up on what Rich was saying about this, I think that, as he says, the rules are directionally correct. But I don't think that the stated objectives of the rules, which is to try to bring down the cost of discovery, can really be achieved until, to complete the analogy I was using before, the kid has to pay for the candy. At that point, I have to start deciding what are my favorites. what are the ones that I really want? And that's what's missing from the amendments, is to step back and really say that we're not going to engage in any presumptions about who's paying, so that ultimately may fall on the requesting party to pay for what it asked for, which I think, in my experience, has been where this has actually happened, where a court has said, "Look, we've taken way too much discovery here already, and so I'm now going to say that either the requesting party pays or the costs be divided." And, you know, invariably when that happens, and it's pretty rare, but when it does happen, the requests either get withdrawn altogether or they are dramatically reduced.
And, you know, in proportionality, while it's a great concept and while properly adjudicated, can reduce discovery, even to the point we were discussing before about the amount of information out there, even reduced discovery can end up costing in the millions and tens of millions of dollars. So that's another reason why building in proportionality and needs is helpful, and it certainly is heading in the right direction, but it's not resolving the problem altogether.
Right. Well, I haven't focused on discovery per se and those costs. In the last 6 months, I've been developing a concept called do less law, where we have general counsels, the clients of your firm, and most of the large law firms are asking for more value. And it's one thing to perform the work more efficiently, but it's another and I think better thing to just do less of it. So I think what you're saying is, and maybe I'm saying is, there's probably way too much discovery in any event, and that not only is costly in its own right, as we've been discussing, but then it drives up the cost of reviewing and finding the information. So I'm very sympathetic to that. I'm wondering, though, if stepping away from exactly how the rules would work, you know, have you thought about litigation as a series of moves, and you have, let's say, plaintiffs, class action lawyers, bringing a lawsuit against a major corporation, you know, do you get one bite of the apple free? I mean, what's kind of cutting the handshake sequence back and forth in your vision where there would be, you would allow some access to justice for those who can't afford it, but charge more to those who can? Is there any thoughts on how it might work practically?
Well, I think that, you know, I think the way it probably should work is that the requests are made, and that the presumption is that the requesting party would pay. The requesting party could go to the court and say, well, there's some extreme circumstances here that suggest that the defendant should pay or pay part of it in this circumstance for whatever legitimate reason might be offered under the criteria that are applicable. But I think if you start with the proposition that the requesting party is going as the burden of sort of moving the rock the other direction, you know, leaves the court involved to make sure that the overall approach is fair, but it puts the burden where it should be to start with, and that is that the presumption is I'm going to have to pay for what I get.
Do you see in that schema that the battles of litigation and discovery would just be shifted to the cost to the cost side? So if those rules, forgetting about again the wording exactly whether they could be passed, whether there's a political judicial will to pass those, if the presumption was that the requesting party paid, but there are exceptions, might we not see a lot of lawyers arguing for the exception and then having a lot of motion battles over those exceptions?
That may be the case, but I think it's probably going to result in a lot more likely compromises on those sorts of issues, because the requesting party probably would have started off with much more tailored requests because they don't know how the process is going to turn out. And, you know, they're not going to ask for substantially more than they think that they're going to be obliged to pay for at the end of the process.
Well, it's also likely to lead to a staged process of discovery where instead of the way it works today, you start broad and ask for everything and then just sort through what you have. The requesting party would really consider what they need in order to evaluate the case and pursue it, and then would renew those requests or make additional requests. So I think it also lends itself to a more intelligent way of proceeding with the process as opposed to the way it typically works now, particularly in large litigations, of asking for everything and saying, I want everything and all of it before I even start taking depositions.
Right. Do you know, I've read some references to the practices in other countries, so I know, and I'm not deeply familiar with them, but I think the Jackson reforms in England are designed to limit production, and I think the Australian courts in the new state of New South Wales have some limits. But is there anything we can learn from some of the practices and experiences in other countries about limiting production costs?
Well, that's a very good point. And to take your Australian example, the system in Australia, to the extent I have familiarity with that, is very different than ours because it really focuses on this staging that I was describing. They're not permitted to do general discovery right off the bat. They have to seek leave to do that. The first thing they do is take very pointed, very tailored, very specific discovery to substantiate their claims and defenses. And then after that process, I believe it's by leave of court, but I do know that there's some process they have to go to. Discovery can be expanded to general discovery, and I think we can take some lessons from that. And I think that's what we're trying to get at with focusing on the payment of it as well.
And I'd add, you know, you've pointed to a couple of countries where there is some semblance of discovery. The vast majority, though, this concept does not exist. You litigate with the information that you have, and there is no such thing as discovery. Now, you know, I think we're probably beyond that stage in the U.S. legal system. So please.
Well, I don't know. I like the Australian system of no depositions. They're not permitted to take depositions, and that's one big limitation on discovery.
But I think we need to start from the point that most legal systems have continued to serve their desired purpose without much, if any, discovery at all.
I think that's a great point, and as part of the research I did for the talk I gave on Do Less Law, I came across a study. It was written about in an article in Corporate Counsel in May of this year that someone did a study and found that the Eurozone average legal cost versus the U.S., the U.S. is spending 1.5 times as much on its legal system as the Eurozone, so it's comparing the U.S. to another developed country or a region, and it feels to me a little bit like healthcare, where we spend a huge amount on both healthcare and on its legal system, and it's not clear we have any better results than other developed countries. So, I understand the economic imperative is certainly there. Do you think, that said, do you see any practical way through the rulemaking process to get there, or is this ultimately going to have to be litigated as a due process issue?
Well, my understanding is the Advisory Committee on Civil Rules, that is on the federal side of our judicial system, these rules are not necessarily the end product, that they're continuing to look at cost issues and in particular the possibility of various forms of cost sharing. And so I have some hope that through the rulemaking process we may be able to find a way to address that issue, although I would be the first to say that any change in the system would likely be controversial. But I do think that as these costs mount, it's quite possible that we will see this sort of due process arguments, a frontal challenge to the rules and to the current process be used because the costs have become so substantial, and I think have reached the level in many cases that I think some defendants are going to feel that they really need to raise those fundamental cost issues.
Oh, that sounds reasonable to me. I think we should wrap fairly soon. So before I get to two closing questions, is there any other points you wanted to raise about either the arguments or the rules?
I think the only other comment that I would raise is that I would hope that some of this can be achieved through the rulemaking process, because I think that having a balanced method of finding ways to address these discovery issues would be preferable. One of the hallmarks of the rules changes that have been proposed is to have a greater court involvement in planning and setting a course for discovery. And I think that really is a noble objective. And if you added to that course charting process, the court being directly involved in making determinations about who will pay for that discovery, I think that is really the way to make sure that the parties are getting what they need in discovery, but that discovery really is a project of fact development and not just a way to inflict pain and achieve leverage versus your foe.
Okay. So let me move to closing. Two unrelated questions. So I believe the articles came out in June, so we've had a couple of months. I was surprised, frankly, as someone doing a lot of social media, that I didn't see more blog or Twitter commentary on it. So I'm curious if you have heard reaction, either public or private, to the ideas you put forward.
We have had quite a bit of comment, most of it coming from clients and those on the defense side, and most of it positive, a lot of questions, a lot of interest in that. I think that perhaps the reason why you haven't seen more commentary from the defense community on this is that everyone is now focusing on the proposed rules amendments for which the comment process is now opened. There'll be three hearings, public hearings, that the Advisory Committee on Civil Rules are going to conduct later this fall and early next year. And I think everyone is really focusing on those and talking about whether those are appropriate and what more needs to be done. And I think you'll probably see in that process a fair amount of commentary about cost shifting, including some of the due process ramifications regarding that possibility.
Good. Well, that it certainly, at minimum, we need to have more airing of this as a policy issue, given the huge expense. And people have been talking about this, but it sounds like that will provide a structured basis, although the outcome, as always in any rulemaking process, hard to predict. So let me ask, and I know as practicing lawyers you may not want to comment, but I'll just put the question here, which is Skadden represents often the defendant in pretty large and high-stake matters where we know the discovery can be costly, and your articles in effect tee up the arguments for a future stand that you might take on behalf of your clients. So is it possible that if the rules don't go the right way, care to comment on whether any of your clients might sort of take you up on the implicit offer to make those arguments in the courts rather than through the rulemaking?
Well, I think we may see the argument somewhere along the line. I think that those sorts of constitutional arguments no one wants to make lightly, and certainly not something that you would lightly decide to burden a court with considering. But I do think in the context of cases that may come up along the road where there are substantial costs involved, I think that sort of argument certainly is going to be considered.
Well, it would be certainly interesting to watch. I think any final comments from either of you?
Well, I think raising the constitutional argument certainly is important, but one of the things we regularly try and do is to raise the cost-shifting argument and frequently advise clients that there's a great benefit always to putting it out there, obviously not on small or insignificant matters or motions, but on some of these high-stake cases. It's always worth raising the argument, dropping a footnote about the constitutional implications of it, and begin to educate the judges and begin to put the judges in the position of having to evaluate the issue of costs, whether it's on, you know, one aspect of a large matter or whether it's on the whole package. So I think it's something that we should continue to do, and that that defendants should continue to be mindful of as they make discovery motions.
I think that's a great idea. As a data-driven kind of person, and knowing that we can search any published decision, being able, whether or not these are head-noted or otherwise marked, being able to find the number of cases where it's raised would tell us something. So I think that sounds like practical advice for the defense bar.
And particularly if you find that judges are continually denying these motions, I think in some respects that's actually helpful and supports the need for this kind of reevaluation.
That, or it at least to the extent that one is able within the court rules to try and pick judges, lets you know which judges to go before.
Exactly.
But we know that's always a challenge, and probably a topic for a separate podcast. So given the time, I think this is a good place to stop. So I want to thank you, John Beisner, Rich Bernardo, partner and counsel with Skadden Arps. Thank you very much for your time today.